Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio lawmakers continue to mull Governor John Kasich's palette of policy proposals, all part of a budget overhaul he unveiled last week. Tax cuts, tax hikes, and a variety of education and other changes. Last week after the announcement, Ohio Representative Jay Hottinger of Newark said that he didn't want to rain on the governor's day. Joining us now to see if the weather has changed yet is Columbus Dispatch Statehouse reporter Jim Siegel. Welcome back to the show, Jim.
Thanks. Good morning.
Cincinnati Inquirer Statehouse reporter Chrissy Thompson. Welcome back, Chrissy.
Thanks for having me.
And in his debut appearance, Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Welcome, Andy.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So tomorrow, it will be a week since the governor unveiled the plan. Where are the trouble spots, Chrissy?
Well, I think we continue to hear from Republicans that they're not real happy about the proposal to increase the commercial activity tax. That's a business tax. It's a tax on all sales within Ohio. Not really that happy about the plan to increase the cigarette tax, but that is kind of a politically easy move, right? So I imagine we'll see at least some of that there. So those are the two things that we keep hearing, you know, and Republicans control both houses of the General Assembly, and they're from the same party as John Kasich. So
it's really all about the Republicans and the severance tax, Jim Siegel.
Yeah, there's concerns about that as well, although the House Republicans currently have a severance tax bill. And for those who aren't up on this, basically the governor wants an 8.5% income tax cut, and he wants to pay for it by essentially raising the severance tax, the tobacco tax, and
the commercial activities tax.
In all, it would only be about $175 million net tax cut over 3 years. So the two sides balance out pretty well.
Right.
But the severance tax, the House Republicans have already been working on a bill that would increase the severance tax in Ohio. This is essentially the tax on the horizontal fracking that is going on right now in the shale areas over in eastern Ohio and southeastern Ohio. But their proposal is considerably lower than what the governor is asking for. The governor has run into this wall twice before trying to propose severance taxes, and it's been shot down by the Republicans in the legislature. And so we'll see where they end up on that. It's just like, to me, all these tax increase proposals are going to be interesting to see how they land. The governor initially said he wanted the goal of his income tax cut was to get the top rate, the rate paid on all income earned above $208,000. He wanted that rate down below 5%. The tax cut he called for was 8.5%. He could go to only even if he only cut it by 6.5%, you'd still get to that goal. So there's wiggle room here, and I don't expect he's going to get everything he wants out of this this tax, but he'll probably get something.
And when you're looking at the House version of the severance tax, they just had a new substitute bill that raised it even more. And when it was first introduced, the industry was on board with it and they were supporting it. And even with
they wrote it.
Right. And with the revised version, they were kind of uneasy about the revised version. Now the governor's version is even more than that. So it'll be interesting to see what happens now.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. How significant is the lobby for the fracking industry in Ohio?
Well, it seems like they just have a very big role in the whole thing. And you always hear the Ohio Oil and Gas Association talk about how it's important to have a low tax to keep Ohio competitive. And they're afraid that if we touch the tax at all, or if we touch the way the governor proposes, that it's going to drive business away. And that's what we keep hearing. If you drive business away, then you're not going to be able to create the jobs that you want here.
Right. You know, the interesting thing I mentioned that I've heard from so many different Republicans that they're, you know, no, over my dead body will there be a CAT increase, or over my dead body will we increase the cigarette tax. But what Speaker Batchelder actually told us last week was, you know, he didn't think the smoking tax was that big of a deal. And he said, you know, I am very concerned about this higher severance tax that the governor has proposed. And that, you know, he's from Medina, so getting close to some of the areas where this fracking occurs, and the lawmakers that are from that area are just very concerned. They say that we're going to be pushing away this business.
So the House bill that's pending that would increase the severance tax on fracking operations, that's not coming from the region where the fracking is taking place? I mean, there, you said there's another House bill out there.
Oh, Huffman's bill.
Mm-hmm. So he's from Lima, so I guess
it's not his.
Although the industry is okay with that, they understand that there has to be some tax, but they don't want anything. The governor's people have not been working. You know, they're not been letting the industry write the bill, so to speak, right? Which is what the lawmakers have been willing to do,
right? And the context here is that the oil and gas industry, of course, does not want more of a severance tax, even though they wrote the original House bill. What they're concerned about is that if this goes out long enough and there's no real severance tax on the books, and Ohio's drilling taxes right now are extremely low because we just haven't, you know, we're not a big drilling state up until now. And so nobody really cared that much. But now that we're beginning to become a major player in the oil and gas drilling and in its fracking, the concern among the industry is that this will go to the ballot and somebody will put this on the ballot as an amendment and or as a ref, you know, as a statute and impose a really significant tax. And they want to head that off. And that's I think that's part of the motivation here. But again, they and the governor are, you know, there's a, you know, the rates don't sound that much different. One wants 2.25% and the other wants 2.75%. But the oil and gas folks seem to argue that that's a significant gap there. So that's largely what we're fighting over.
A referendum on the ballot would be dangerous because haven't polls shown that voters are very supportive of increasing the fracking tax?
Yes, and that's what the industry is worried about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, talk again about typically politically easy, you know, raise the tax on smokers. Okay, that's fine. Typically politically, right? Mm-hmm. Raise the tax on oil and gas. No problem. Typically politically, right? But there have been a lot of growth in this industry and a lot of jobs, and the lawmakers are really afraid that that'll go away.
And some groups say that maybe there's one proposal out there from last week that said that Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Ohio should get together and create a standard regional
tax. So they're not competing with each other.
Right. And they're saying if you do compete against each other, you're all competing for the low road. Who can get it the lowest? Who can make the tax so low that you don't provide as much money back to the community for the infrastructure and everything like that, too? So they want all three states to get together and say, we're not going to go below 5%. And that's where West Virginia is right now.
Yeah, Pennsylvania's been doing this longer than Ohio has. Right. They don't have a severance tax, but they have other fees that they use that are, you know, some would say equivalent or even higher than what Ohio's ultimate tax would end up being. So that seems like that would make sense from an economic standpoint to come up with some type of a regional tax so you're not fighting with each other, I have no sense of whether any of the three states would be on board with doing that, but
and I don't have
is it even legal? I mean, is it necessarily colluding like that on tax? I mean, I don't know.
I have
colluding's a pejorative word. I don't mean
that.
Yeah,
I mean,
but
collusion tends to be more of a private market thing, but I don't know.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Jim brings up a point that I don't have the actual list, but even if the governor's proposal, for instance, for the fracking tax were to pass, which, you know, lawmakers are saying they're worried is too high.
As it stands.
Correct.
Yeah.
We would not in Ohio have anywhere close to the highest tax for this. It still would be relatively low. Jim and Andy might be able to have more of a
in Texas,
on that,
it's what, 30 or something percent or super.
Well, I think the chart that the administration put out shows that we'd still be among like the bottom, at least the bottom five in the nation, even if the governor's plan were to pass. Now, you've often heard the oil and gas industry argue against that, saying that, you know, you're not comparing apples to apples when you're talking to other states, because other states, it is very difficult to make comparisons. They tax this drilling in different ways, so they will argue that that's not really a great comparison. But yeah, we'll see. And the other thing I'd point out about this income tax cut is not everyone, believe it or not, among Republican lawmakers thinks an income tax cut, another one, is where we need to go right now. You know, remember, we're just coming off of a passage last year of a 10% income tax cut, and he wants to add another 8.5%. There are some who are saying, you know, there are other things out there that we may need to do. There's other taxes like the CAT tax that are also not good, and maybe we shouldn't be raising that.
We owe for the other one.
Yeah, right. we owe $1.3 billion in unemployment compensation debt to the federal government, and businesses are paying that every year.
Name one Republican that is going to say they're opposed.
I'll tell you, the story ran in Gannett's Central Ohio papers over the weekend, and it runs in the Inquirer tomorrow. But I talked to Bill Seitz about just the tax proposal in general.
He's from Cincinnati,
right. And he's a state senator. He's a pretty powerful state senator.
Been around a long time.
Yeah,
too.
And usually quite moderate, right? And he said, you know, the governor's whole point, he said all along, is to get the tax down for the top ratepayers. He said, now that's 2% of Ohioans. Bill Seitz said this, 2% of Ohioans. And you're going to raise the smoking tax on 25% of Ohioans to pay for this tax cut. Now, it is an across-the-board tax cut, but Bill was focusing in on this top bracket. This is what progressives say, right, when they're opposing the governor's tax plan. So to hear that argument come from Seitz, and he also had some problems with the CAT proposal also. And he said, you know, if this is the only way to pay for this income tax cut, we've been cutting the taxes in Ohio since 2005. The income taxes, I think, have fallen 25% since 2005. We just don't need to do this then.
The commercial activity tax sometimes is confusing when we just whip it out there as if it's the tax on goods and services that are purchased between businesses. So what I buy from a supplier and pay a supplier to the tax I pay on that. Right.
Right. And then they pay it when you purchase the product. It's
right.
paid by the but it's a business tax. It's
right.
It's not doesn't show up on any receipts. I mean, you know, it's built into the price of your product. But it's a gross receipts tax. It was designed in 2005, back when they did that 21% income tax cut.
Graduated
over 5 years. Mm-hmm. Actually ended up being over six because they delayed it 1 year. But mm-hmm. But yeah, that was designed. It's a 0.26% tax. It was designed to be a very low rate, but a very broad tax. So it covered everything. Very few loopholes. There have been a few loopholes built in there, oil and gas, for example. But you know, and there are some reasons for that. But it was meant to be low and broad. And the concern is actually the funny thing is that the concern at the time among the business community wasn't that it was the tax was being created, because it was actually replacing the corporate income tax, which for a tax collection stunk. It was full of loopholes. So this was much simpler. However, they were worried that because you were making it so simple, you were making it very simple to raise. It's very easy to take a tax from 0.26 to 0.3, which is what the governor's asking to do, and just say, you know, it's just a little knock, you know, inching
15%,
upward.
Yeah.
And they were worried then that that's what it would happen. And
interesting.
And it's, you know, now it's 8 years later, and here they are, you know, going to some sectors, especially retailers, wholesalers, are going to be fighting against this.
Retail, wholesalers, the Ohio Chamber is against it. Smaller businesses, I don't know if the National Federation of Independent Businesses has come out against it or not, but...
Well, most of them won't pay it. You've got to have $1 million in gross
right.
receipts
so
before you
get
this.
So it's more medium-sized businesses. Right. Medium to larger businesses are going to be hit by it. But medium-sized businesses have been kind of, a lot of them work on pretty narrow margins of profit.
Yeah, I think, I hope I get this right, but I think if it's a...
They don't keep a lot on hand, yeah.
A high-volume, low-margin business
right.
is the one that is impacted the most by this. So...
Yeah, grocers hate this tax, and then this was a tax to help with manufacturing too.
Mm-hmm.
Manufacturers don't pay this nearly as much as they used to pay
so
on the corporate
franchise. No big rub for Honda.
Right, and any sale that you make outside of the state doesn't fall under the. So it's only sales within Ohio.
Right.
Okay.
So.
And when you go back to the severance tax proposal and add this to this CAT proposal, the American Petroleum Institute says it's really starting to stack up for those businesses that are in the oil and gas industry and maybe those downstream groups too.
Not oil and gas directly, but the
downstream
supply to
mm-hmm.
them. Okay. We will return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Joining me in the studio, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio, State House News Bureau, and Chrissy Thompson for the Cincinnati Inquirer. We're talking about state government and politics this hour. What do you want to talk about? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Any questions about the governor's budget correction bill? Any ideas about whether or not the taxes should go up or down? Or what about the Ohio voters' Bill of Rights? The number is 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can tweet us at WOSU All Sides. So supporters of an Ohio Voters Bill of Rights got the go-ahead from the Ohio Ballot Board to begin gathering signatures to put the amendment on the November ballot. What rights would voters enjoy if they approved this proposed constitutional amendment? Andy Chow?
I guess you could start with the Golden Week, that week where you can still register.
That would return?
Would it not? Yeah, the Golden Week would return so you can register to vote and vote in person early at the same time. And that's something that was just eliminated by a bill and goes into law pretty soon here.
The governor's expected to sign it, right?
He already signed it, so it's just a matter of time till it actually goes into effect.
So that's it? Just a reinstatement of Golden Week or anything else?
Set some new minimum voting hours for in-person early voting.
Yeah, it changes. So we have this ruling on right church, wrong pew, right? So under this amendment, that would kind of be overridden while the Constitution would be changed. So that ruling would not even apply, and the amendment would say if you anywhere you vote. Within your precinct, your vote has to count.
I think it's
is that broader. Right?
I think it's within your county.
Oh, like, no, you're right. The county. You're totally right.
The lowest.
I apologize. Yes. Yeah. Anywhere you vote within your your county. So you could go to the wrong polling place.
Which I've done.
I've done too.
This is a total drag.
As of right now, I believe the Bill Sides quote was no soup for you if you go to the wrong polling place.
It was the year that the lines were out the doors, even in Worthington, mm-hmm. which is very efficient. Mm-hmm. And I waited in line for 2 hours until I got near the front of the line and started thinking, I just don't remember seeing all these people. I didn't know this guy was in my precinct and that guy. And finally I asked. Yeah, well, you know what happens.
But you went to your correct place and cast your vote.
Then I had to go to the correct place.
Because you care about voting.
Good job. But not everybody has the resources or the luxury of time to do that.
Right. Yeah, and what this is the supporters hope to do, and this is the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus, Democrats, other progressive groups that are pushing for this is, I mean, they want to get, you know, essentially when you're putting this stuff in the Constitution, you're kind of chiseling it in stone, whereas it's much more fluid when you get laws passed. And this is the culmination of years of partisan battles in the legislature over election laws, over everything from, you know, a lot of things that this voter bill of rights, as it's called, is trying to touch on in terms of what kind of identification you need at the polls. I think this would make some modifications to that. The provisional balloting, like Chrissy talked about, it's just a lot of the things that Democrats would like to see occur that they believe would allow for more ballot access. And let's face it, it would allow for more access for people who tend to vote Democratic. The more early voting and the more weekend hours, the more evening hours you have, the better Democratic turnout tends to be.
But Republicans have said, why does everybody criticize them? They're the ones that enacted, for instance, the Golden Week to begin with.
Right. They did it in 2005, I believe. But they did. I mean, they put the 35-day early voting in place.
So if they did that back then, why did they change it this year?
Well, when they put it in, you got to remember why they put it in place. They put it in place not because necessarily they got up one morning and thought we should have early voting and it should be 35 days. There was a constitutional amendment on the ballot, again pushed by progressive groups and others like the League of Women Voters, some other what they might call good government groups. There was a package of issues on the ballot that would have, and one of which would have increased early voting, and so they wanted to kind of get out in front of that. And so the Republicans passed it on their own and made sure that it got into law before the vote. And then the issue was defeated along with the other package of proposals. So now they're saying, well, we never really meant to create Golden Week. That was always a mistake. And frankly, they've been saying that ever since the beginning. And I'm not I frankly, I believe them. I think they rushed that bill through because they were trying to cut off the ballot issue at the time. And so I just don't think they thought enough about, oh, wait, we're creating a week in which people can do same day registration and voting. And I think they do want to correct that. But the other issue there, when you combine that with the fact that when John Huston puts out a directive of the Secretary of State and it includes two Saturdays, but it includes no Sunday voting during that time, and it includes no voting on the Sunday or Monday before the election, that's where Democrats get upset.
They need about 385,000 signatures. Who's behind this Ohio Voters Bill of Rights, and do they have what it takes to get the job done, to get the signatures they need?
The main leader of the effort is Alicia Reese. She's a state representative from Cincinnati, and she is head of the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus. As Jim mentioned, a lot of these, it's just fact that a lot of these, if you cut back on early voting hours or absentee voting or things like that, it just tends to affect more
Democrats,
minorities and urban voters and things like that. So that's why the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus is making this an issue. Or something that they want to, you know, to champion. So they are working with a lot of Mason groups. Rep Reese is a Mason, working with a lot of NAACP groups. The Ohio NAACP is behind
them. That are
going
to go out and collect the signatures?
Yeah. It's going to be mostly volunteer-led, which that's the challenge, right? It's not just 385,000 signatures that they need. They probably need well over 500,000 because some of them won't be validated. And it's really expensive to gather all these signatures, and they don't have a lot of time. They have till July 2nd. We just talked, I think, last week about the efforts that the marijuana advocates are trying to put together to gather that many signatures in that amount of time. And they think they need a couple $1 million to do it, which is pretty typical. So,
in other words, they have to pay people.
Right. Usually you pay signature gatherers to go get these signatures for you. So they're going to try to do it all grassroots, bring them to churches, bring them to union meetings, bring them to college activist gatherings, things like that. I don't know if they're going to be able to do it. Honestly, it's a huge task, but they're very passionate about it, and they are relatively united on this front. So,
well, they were able to, when was the redistricting initiative? Was it last year or 2012? They were able to tap in to get signatures for that too, and it's kind of the same sentiment. People being told that they need to strengthen their rights as voters to be able to have their voice heard in a different way. So, if they were able to do it for the redistricting initiative, I feel like they might be able to kind of get the same momentum going for Voters Bill of Rights.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's just one question, though, this time. The last time it was pretty complicated. It included redistricting components and that sort of thing.
Right, that's not part of it this time.
Right.
It's just
this is just about voting.
Voting, right. It's interesting. This amendment has a couple of pieces that Attorney General DeWine rejected it at first, and they ended up having to add a couple of things that say, federal law doesn't, for instance, federal law doesn't allow you to use a college ID as your voter ID, but that's in the amendment. So they have to list a couple of places where it doesn't quite mesh up with federal law, and I'm not sure the implications of that if that were to pass. So.
Okay. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. A new bill is in the Ohio Senate that would ban the direct sales model of Tesla Motors. Seems like a bunch of free market conservatives, the like of which fill the Ohio General Assembly these days, would not embrace this measure. It seems like it's protectionism. What's going on? Who wants to take a stab?
Well, it's and that is actually what Tesla is arguing to them. I mean, I've seen some of the letters they've sent out to the members. I've heard some of the some of the arguments they're making, and that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to impose, tell them, look, you guys are capitalists. You're free market conservatives. This is not what you should be supporting. You should be allowing Tesla to come in. And the argument here is that Tesla wants to, which makes these, I think they're electric.
Yeah, they're electric
cars.
Very expensive luxury electric cars.
Right. Tesla wants to come in. They don't want to have dealerships like you currently see you know, everywhere in Ohio. They want direct sales. They
want
to, and the auto dealers, as you would expect, are very concerned about this. That this is going to, you know, if this catches on and is allowed and grows, then other manufacturers could try to maybe start to do this as well and just cut dealers out all over the place. And so there's, you know, they believe this is a fight. This is a fight that's been going on in other states. Tesla is not having a lot of success in a lot of these other states. They're getting blocked. Auto dealers are a very politically powerful organization in all over the country. So this is a big
New Jersey
fight.
Just banned them, but now it's going to go to court, and that's a whole different ball of wax, isn't it? Once you go to court.
Yeah. I think. It's important to remember, though, that, I mean, franchise law has been written to protect auto dealers before we had cars, since we've had carriages, actually. So, it would be a different ball of wax in court, but, again, these laws were specifically written to protect this model. I mean, auto dealers live in constant fear. I think back when I covered the auto industry in Detroit. Just think back to the thousands of franchises that were going to be taken away from GM and Chrysler dealers. The way that these auto dealer networks are set up, there's one in every statehouse district, pretty much, you know, right?
Uh-huh.
And they're usually the biggest political donor in that area. You know, that lobby got together and they lobbied Congress, and in the end, more than 1,000 dealers were reinstated, or their franchises were reinstated. So it was a pretty powerful show of what these people can do politically, and I think it would be a big surprise if something like this were to be able to get through even the Ohio General Assembly.
Yeah. Well, and Tesla has to get really creative in these other states. Like you said, New Jersey just banned them. They're banned in other states now. They have to, instead of stores, they have to have galleries, and people can go visit and look at these cars almost like a piece of art and not a piece of
manufacturing. You can't drive it or anything.
And you can't drive it or anything. You just get to look at it, and they can't tell you the price of it or anything like that. And then they have to go home and buy it online. And so, that's not what you have. You can go to a store in Ohio now, but if Ohio bans it, it's going to turn into one of these gallery-type settings.
Because remember, this is the difference, right, between when the manufacturer owns the dealership, which is what Tesla wants to do. They can fire people, hire people, make their own rules, tell you what posters to hang where, et cetera, et cetera. Right now, the way it's set up, it's very rare. There are a couple of very, very rare exceptions. A lot of them were actually Saturn dealerships, which aren't around anymore, but where an automaker owns a dealership. And so they would give you an incentive, like some sort of financial incentive, to try to do what they want you to do.
Uh-huh.
They would set sales goals for you, and they might be able to take away some of your cars or things like that, but they can't really control you. And the dealers like it that way. They want to be their own bosses. So.
Al in Ridgeville, you're on the air. Hi, Al.
Hi. I just wanted to point out the tight-knit relationship between the Republicans and the legislature and the auto dealers. When the legislature did SB5, they actually put in a pork barrel item that turned all the regulation of auto dealerships over to a panel of auto dealers and removed all the civilians. So there is this historic tight relationship between the two groups.
I'm sorry, what bill was this in?
SB5, the union breaking bill.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I read the whole thing.
who knew? Okay, interesting. And why'd they do that? I mean, were they getting some friction from civilians on the?
Well, I think it was. Basically pork. You know, the auto dealers have a lot of money. They don't want to be regulated by the state. Okay. They were, you know, the legislatures were giving payback to the auto dealers by saying, okay, you can regulate yourselves and we won't have any civilian oversight.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Al.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yet another I guess, testimonial for the relationship between the auto dealerships and auto dealers and the Ohio General Assembly in down there at the State House. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Joining me in the studio, Chrissy Thompson for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Andy Chow with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. We're talking about state government and politics. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Alan in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Alan.
Hi, how are you all this morning?
Fine, thanks.
Yeah, I was calling to ask about the voter Bill of Rights, which said that says that a voter has the right to vote in any voting location within his or her precinct.
Well, within her county, we think it's within his or her county.
Within his or her county.
Yeah.
Okay. Then how does the Board of Elections going to handle that? That's going to create an enormous problem, I should think. I've been a roster judge for most of the elections for the past 10 years or so. And I just see enormous problems being created in keeping track of all that paperwork.
Provisional ballots. Okay,
I don't believe that the Board of Elections officials support this. Generally, the elections okay. officials don't support it. And you know, so something that like that Democrats would say is that we shouldn't be trying to make elections easier for elections officials. This is about voters. So
yeah, and the issue there is, I mean, if you vote, if you cast a ballot, if this were to pass, and say you cast a ballot in the wrong polling location, and you cast a provisional ballot, then what they essentially would do under this is they would only count your votes on races that you are legally allowed to vote for. So if there's a statewide race, whatever statewide races there are, whatever countywide races there are, you know, those would count, but others just would not, and that's. And that is where, you know, I suppose it could definitely have a, you know, administrative
Yeah, if you're voting on another township's levy or something like that, that doesn't concern you.
Right. And Democrats say this should be the case because if you're voting in the wrong polling location, the Democrats and some of these other groups argue that that's probably because a poll worker did not properly inform you that you're voting in the wrong place. So that now I don't know if that's
right.
the case, but that's their argument, and that's and frankly, I mean, and who is going to purposefully vote in the wrong place? I don't you know, it's I suppose it could happen, but yeah, that's why they say they should be counted.
Okay. Alan in Clintonville, thanks a lot for your call. So Tesla Motors, we're done with that. It's not gonna pass. Forget about it, but do you think that they will take it to court if it doesn't, like they're threatening to do, or maybe you already have in New Jersey? So is it not a done deal, or?
Well, no. I don't know. It might pass. I mean, if it does pass, I think then they go to court.
I think I should be clear. What I did say is that I don't think that anything that hurts the auto dealers. Will pass. Mm. This okay. bill would hurt Tesla.
Yes.
So it might pass, but there
gotcha.
Would the opposite would have no chance. So I think I was just talking in terms of the auto dealers getting their way.
Gotcha.
That's all
okay.
I meant to say there.
The state remains mum on the question of whether a northeastern Ohio fracking operation caused a series of earthquakes in Mahoning County. That, along with the governor's proposal to increase the severance tax on the fracking industry, doesn't look good for the fracking industry. But what about the state's role in this? Do any of you guys have a sense about what the state should be doing and what is being done?
Well, ODNR says that they're not going to talk about anything until they collect all the data, look at everything, and get a good sense of what's actually going on. So that's why they're staying quiet right now. And right now, their geologist in Columbia University says that he's pretty sure that this a fracking well in Mahoning County is what caused the earthquake. He says, look at all the earthquakes in the past 100 years in Ohio, and then look at all the activity, all the seismic activity in the past couple of years as fracking has ramped up. And he says there's been a clear difference between the amount of earthquakes we had in the first 100 years and then the past 5 years. Mm-hmm. And so, and this is an expert on, I guess, man-caused seismic events. So the state, it'll be interesting to see what they come out of this. They, researchers looked at the earthquakes at the end of 2011, mm-hmm. and researchers said that that injection well is what caused those magnitude
3.0. Which is a storage well for the stuff that comes out of the fracking wells.
Yeah, and that's what the significance of this would be. I don't think there's ever been any clear connection between a fracking well and an earthquake before.
In the U.S.
In the U.S.
Right.
The doctor from Columbia University says that there has been some evidence in Canada. So it'll be significant if they do find any type of connection to this well and what happens after that.
Yeah, I mean, you just look at the number. The concerns are like Andy said, it's about the numbers. In Mahoning County, I think in the last 100 years, I think they had zero earthquakes mm-hmm. up until they started getting them with this injection well, and now those seem to stop. Now we seem to be getting more, and I won't pretend to tell you what's causing them necessarily at this point, but people are worried, and I think and what you have to. As folks are watching this, particularly us in the media, there's a concern, with ODNR not saying anything yet. And I understand they want to get mm-hmm. gather the facts first. But there's a concern that there could, politically, this is a very, fracking is very important. And it's been hailed as a, as a savior for that region out there. And if there's suddenly, real evidence that shows that these things could be causing, some kind of environmental harm or earthquakes, then how are they going to deal with that? And it's going to be, something everybody wants to keep a close eye on.
Mark and Bexley, you want to return to the voting issue? Welcome, Mark.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, how does one actually cast a ballot in the wrong precinct? And the reason I ask is I live in Bexley, and when I go to vote at the local high school, I come to the table and there is a log that has my signature, my address, I provide ID, and my understanding is I can't get that little card and go in the booth if that doesn't match up. So how does one actually cast a ballot if they can't, the poll worker can't match up my name, my signature, and my ID to the log for that precinct? I don't understand how that works. Maybe I misunderstand the process, but I think that if I don't have proper ID matching to their log, including address, and there's a signature from the prior year, that I can't cast a ballot. Is that not correct, or how does someone cast a ballot in the wrong precinct?
Well, I think the idea is that you go to the wrong precinct.
Well, there are some polling places that have multiple precincts. That is the court case about this was related to that, where there are some polling places that have multiple precincts in them. And so that's where it first started. But this Voter Bill of Rights would go beyond that, though.
Right. And the caller is correct. You can't cast a regular ballot if your name is not on the poll book and you don't have a signature that matches up and you don't have identification. A provisional ballot is allowed to be cast because there's circumstances where the person is a legitimate voter, but a common reason is, for example, maybe you have moved in the last couple months, but you haven't updated your voter registration yet. So what you do is you cast a provisional ballot because you're not on the books in your new address. So you cast a provisional ballot. You then go and rectify that. You take your information down to the Board of Elections and you make sure that that is cleared up and that is verified that you in fact do live where your new location, and then your ballot gets counted, and so that's an example of how this can happen. Now the problem is if you go in and say, some reason you end up at the wrong precinct or the wrong voting location, and the poll worker allows you to cast a ballot there, even though maybe you got your new address wrong, maybe they just don't understand. Maybe they thought you said street instead of drive, and that's in a different part of the area. So things can happen, and you can end up casting a ballot in the wrong place, and that's kind of where the fight is over.
Sounds crazy, but it happens. Mark, thanks a lot for your call. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The Constitutional Modernization Commission, I was excited to read, has named an executive director. Is this a big step forward for a panel formed 3 years ago, Jim Siegel, who wrote that blockbuster story?
Well, it is, in that they, you know, this
seriously.
Is, well, this is a panel that it's a 32-member panel. It was created back in, you know, late 2011 as a, and it's designed with good intentions, in that it's supposed to be a group that's going to bring come together a lot of experts, both, you know, lawmakers and public law experts, and have them craft changes to the Constitution, clean things up, make big changes, make small changes, and have them put on, you know, the legislature put them on the ballot. And the problem is that they hadn't until last week hired an executive director, and that also means they hadn't hired any staff either. And so you basically had the two chambers, the Senate and the House, kind of running it. You know, the Speaker Bill Batchelder, who spearheaded it, he was sort of in charge, but, you know, he couldn't do anything unilaterally. There were staff members from the House and Senate who were working on it, but not, you know, but it was a hodgepodge of folks who were, you know, that while they were trying to do good work, there was no one leading the charge. And therefore, and, you know, so right now we're still without any recommendations from the panel. And we're now there. The hope is, now that we have an executive director, this took a while to get them to work this out, but now that we have one, that they'll start making some recommendations on things like term limits, redistricting, judicial elections, and a whole host of other things they're talking about. Maybe we'll start seeing some of these come out and maybe getting them on the ballot.
And where are we if we're communications director? Aren't they looking for a communications director too? Or
yes, I'm sure. My guess is they're going to hire at least a communications director and a legal advisor.
Because at one point I was sitting in on the meeting and they said, well, if we get an executive director, why not just make that executive director the communications director too? And I was thinking, well, we're piling on a lot of stuff for one person at that point. So,
because they don't want to spend money.
Right.
I'm just making a stab at that right now.
Yeah.
But
I think, yes, that's exactly that might what have something to do with it.
Mm-hmm. And it is just the Constitution, you know, so what's the big hairy deal? All right, back to the darn voting issue. James in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, James.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wondered if there was any anything a voter who was denied their vote when you're forced to do a provisional ballot, then you get a letter after that from the League of Women's Voters that they did an audit and your vote wasn't counted. What can you do to, can you sue somebody? Can you do, I don't care about the money, I'll donate it to charity, but
I don't know.
Is there anything, recourse of action for a voter wrongfully denied their vote?
I would guess there probably is. I mean, there was, you know, there have been fights in the legislature over this and that, but it didn't go to court. It was there was a very close House race, you know, last year or actually 2 years ago, decided by just a dozen or so votes. And Democrats were trying to get some of those provisional votes counted. Unfortunately, when they challenge it, the recourse is to go through the legislative process and have a, you know, legislative panel that meets and decides whether the vote should count. That panel, of course, was controlled by the majority Republicans, who, of course, voted that they shouldn't be counted, so that the Republican ended up winning. But I don't know if there. I've never heard of anyone going to court to challenge this. I suppose it's possible. But.
All right. Good luck, James. A House committee has approved a bill that would allow Ohio hunters to use silencers. Jim Siegel, you wrote that the League of Ohio Sportsmen calls it a bad bill with good intentions. So who is for the measure?
Well, there's a lot of gun groups that are supportive, the Buckeye Firearms Association among them.
Why?
Well, they say it's a hearing issue. They want to make sure that hunters don't damage their hearing so that these silencers will assist in that.
They also say that you can still hear the gun go off with a silencer, that it's not a safety issue.
So why don't they just wear earplugs?
Well, so a lot of them do, but then they argue that, well, then you have a hard time hearing when other people are maybe trying to tell you something, give you a command.
Get out of the way.
Watch out,
shooting.
Duck. I don't know, yeah. Whatever they want to yell. You have a hard time hearing that. So, you know, that's the argument. They took a number of lawmakers and legislative aides out to a firing range last month and did some tests to show them that, you know, what it sounds like with a silencer. So my guess is this bill probably will pass the House soon, at least, and we'll see what the Senate wants to do.
A lot of these bills, it's very interesting to see them pass the House, and then we'll just see what happens in the Senate. But some of them don't get taken up, really.
Okay, so another bill would set standards for safe storage of firearms, but that's been stalled. What do we know about that?
Do you know who sponsored the bill?
I do not.
think it's Bill Patman, a Democrat out of Cleveland.
But he got two hearings, which is good for a Democrat.
Yeah. A version of that bill has been around for a long time, and it has always struggled to get a vote.
It gained some momentum last year when the joint committee to talk about school safety was meeting a lot, and a lot of experts said, if you want to try to keep schools safer, maybe you should rethink your storage laws as well, and maybe try to shore up those laws that make sure that kids can't even get access to the firearms when they're at home.
Kenneth, in Clintonville, you're on the air. You want to talk about low voter turnout?
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at what happened in Russia this past week. They seem to have an awful big percentage of vote, and we are lucky to get 20% to vote here. So we're spending a lot of time messing around with rules and regs about voting, and no weekend voting. It has to be happening on a Tuesday, which goes back to agricultural times, or I don't know. It seems strange to me that we're making it more difficult to vote, and we can't get any participation in voting to start with.
Well, okay, and thank you, Kenneth. I mean, people have made that argument that this constant changing around is confusing people and demoralizing some people, but mainly confusing people.
Well, advocates for this Voters Bill of Rights thing, they say that the best way to increase this turnout is to increase the hours of the weekend right before Election Day. And so I think that's one of their main concerns.
Crimea just held the election to secede from the Ukraine, and they had all the Russian armored vehicles out front of their polling places. So maybe there could be some motivation. Maybe we should, you know, bring in some military presence. That might get people to vote more.
Yeah.
He's kidding.
I'm kidding, of course.
There you go. Drug bills. One passed that would allow friends and families that qualify to have access to a drug to give to people when they are going into an overdose. Andy Chow, what do we know? What's going on?
Well, the legislators say they want to take on the drug problem in Ohio comprehensively. They want to take it on from all angles, but they say they can't get anybody help if they die from an overdose. So along with trying to add educational measures, along with trying to get them the treatment that they need, they say that they need to also make sure that they live. And so if they happen to overdose on heroin, or if they happen to overdose on some sort of substance, this drug, naloxone, will actually reverse the effects of an overdose. And so they say if somebody shows signs of addiction and somebody is at risk, then they should be able to give them or their friends or their family this drug that can reverse the effects of it.
Right. And before this law passed, the way it was set up is naloxone, or the trade name is Narcan. It's a drop that you put actually in someone's nose. You could go and get a prescription yourself. Say I'm a heroin or an opiate user. I could go myself and say, hey, I'm addicted to this stuff. I'm worried something's going to happen, and I could get a prescription. I could bring my mom with me, say, and say, as I'm learning to use this, you know, have her watch, right? But she couldn't get the prescription. So unless she was able to get me to come in myself as the drug user to get the prescription for this medicine, there wouldn't be one in my home. And of course, the drug user, if they're overdosing, is not able to give themselves this drug themselves. Police weren't able to use it. Firefighters weren't able to use
EMS?
It. Only paramedics could use it, right? So, but usually first responders come from the fire department or from the police department, and you've got about 4 minutes to give this drug to save someone's life. So really, it was working, but it wasn't getting into the right places, they really felt. So, yeah.
And I'll just say, it's been interesting over the years to watch how the legislature, particularly the House, has, you know, evolved on the issue of drug use and drug abuse. I mean, Speaker Bill Batchelder gets a lot of credit for this in educating his members, and they really are doing a lot of things outside of just let's throw them in jail, let's bust the drug dealers, let's bust the growers, and they're really trying to find some different ways to treat this and deal with this problem.
Time to have changed from the early 1990s, that is for sure. Andy Chow, reporter at Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Chrissy Thompson of the Cincinnati Inquirer, as always, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks as well to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.